from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Columnist, gadfly, reporter, and provocateur, Bruce Anderson has been a fixture for years with the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which calls itself America's last newspaper. He joins us to talk about his recently published memoir, The Mendocino Papers, which is both personal and political, as well as historical, as he takes us from his own journey from San Francisco up through the coast to Mendocino with tales from the time of the Native American indigenous peoples to characters and issues of the present day. Bruce Anderson joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Since 1984, with the brief exception of a couple of years up in Oregon, Bruce Anderson has owned and edited the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a community newspaper founded in 1955 in Boonville in Mendocino County. Calling itself America's last newspaper and standing for, quote, fanning the flames of discontent, end of quote, the newspaper has had a national profile for many years, now under Anderson's leadership, with stories that are often centered on activity in and around Mendocino. Bruce Anderson has recently published the first volume of the Mendocino Papers, an ambitious history of the region, as well as a personal and familial history of Bruce Anderson, who once described himself as a socialist with strong, nay, overwhelming anarchist instincts. And Bruce Anderson joins us for this forum hour. And good to have you at last in the studio here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Mutual admirers for years now, and 34 years the Advertiser has been in Mendocino, the least chronicled area of all the United States. You call it, why?
Well, this vast area, and everybody's aware of it, the 6 million people of the Bay Area, very few people know anything about it except for the tourist areas along the Pacific coast. But the interior and the history, virtually unknown. Humboldt County has a very fine historian, Ray Raphael, who's written some wonderful books.
He's been on this program, in fact,
on the Humboldt County area. But Mendocino County remains pretty much unchronicled.
Well, not anymore. Not that your book is out. By the way, before we talk about the book, how many? You bought it for $20,000, the Anderson Advertiser. I want to talk about the paper just initially. How many people think that it's like George Lucas lived in Lucas Valley, Bruce Anderson lives in Andersonville? They think that that's your paper's name?
Or? Lots of people do. And I'm able to fudge credit applications by insinuating myself as the owner of the whole place.
It's also, we were talking about how you've developed this national following with the paper and have writers like Coburn writing for you, Alexander Coburn. How does that work for you? How do you bring in somebody
like
Coburn?
Well, Coburn also lives in the area. He lives a little farther north in Humboldt County. But from the beginning, since the Advertiser really served the population of the Anderson Valley only, which was too small objectively to support a paper, certainly a paper like mine. So the idea was to make it as interesting as possible, even the local stuff, to a larger, wider readership, simply to make it viable commercially.
This is sort of what we do a lot of the time, now that you mention it. But it has always had a decidedly left political slant. And when I read your memoir, I saw the name of I.F. Stone mentioned, to some extent, a model, an icon for you.
An icon for me and for many others, as were people like Paul Krasner from The Realist magazine, The Old Minority of One, if you remember that
sure,
one, M.S. Arnone. All of those publications were important to me when I was young and inspirational to me.
And you get into your family history in this, the whole story of how you came to Mendocino. You started out here in San Francisco, and I want to make my listeners aware of what you say about San Francisco, but really, it's a whole sense of the family line. Going back to Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, Jonathan Edwards, I discovered.
That's what we're...
And then Ralph Edwards of the old TV show.
Right, the old TV show. Mm-hmm.
They're related to you through your, I mean, let's talk about the
on
lineage.
The maternal
yeah.
side.
Yeah.
But I was struck by the Mendocino County history, what there is of it, the early history particularly. It was largely, the county was largely settled by people from Missouri, southern Missouri, people who wanted to elude or escape the Civil War, and people who had come out from the Missouri and the southern states to mine for gold, including Jesse James' father was last heard of from in Placerville. But anyway, a lot of those people then, having failed in the gold fields, then moved back west into the wilds of Mendocino County. And on my maternal side of my family, many of my relatives also originated in that part of the country.
Well, when you start reading the history that you provide, it's almost a kind of, forgive me, cowboys and Indians. I mean, you even read about Wyatt Earp having been up there, but then you read about, well, Judge Hastings. I mean, and these kinds of stories that people probably aren't all that familiar with. Let's talk about that. I mean, you wanted to tell those stories.
I wanted to tell those stories because although they've been told or at least alluded to in vague memoirs, in a very fine book called Genocide and Vendetta, which was litigated into silence immediately upon publication in the middle 50s by the University of Oklahoma Press. But Genocide and Vendetta, the title of the book, pretty much sums up the early history of Mendocino County. And that Judge Hastings, after whom the Hastings Law School is named, was a pivotal figure in the early history of Mendocino County. He owned a large ranch near Covelo in eastern Mendocino County. A prize stallion of his, he was breeding horses there, prize stallion was killed by Indians who were retaliating against Hastings for various atrocities committed, particularly by Hastings' ranch foreman. They killed Hastings' prize stallions. Hastings, being one of the founders of the California Supreme Court and first Chief Justice, went to the state legislature in 1859 and said, we have to do something about these people. The Indians are seriously in the way. And which commenced a year-long period and longer of systematic hunting of Native Americans for bounty. The state hired a bounty hunter, a man by the name of Jarbo. He assembled a group of killers, Jarbo's Rangers, and they basically killed every Indian man, woman, and child that they could find in the interior areas of Mendocino County, the Eel River Basin running up into Humboldt County.
The newspapers were actually advocating extermination, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, the newspapers were. And then after the extermination, then there was a long period of formal, legal indentured servitude, a form of slavery for the surviving Native Americans. When Hastings died at the turn of the century, I think 1902, he left $1 million to the University of California, after whom the Hastings Law School is called, which is kind of like calling UCSF the Mengele Research Center. I mean, it's quite appalling, but it's a little-known fact of California history.
The character Texan Boy?
A Texan Boy was a 6 foot, 7 inch psychopath who functioned as Hastings' ranch foreman. And he was just a legend in the interior area of Mendocino County. He was, I'm sure, to the Native Americans, he was the biggest white person they'd ever seen. And of course, he murdered Indians on sight and was reimbursed by the state for doing it.
Actually, your book is a book about many psychopaths in the sense that somehow that region, I mean, I was blown away by it. I mean, the Mansons were there for a while. Jim Jones was there. Tree Frog Johnson and Kenneth Parnell, the two infamous kidnappers. Lawrence Lake and Charles Ng. I mean, it's a list. It's a gallery of, psychopaths.
Yes. Not only were they there, they'd all touched down in the Anderson Valley, which I'm sure makes that area absolutely unique in national history.
What was the magnet?
I think just the proximity to the Bay Area, of course, the 60s, the kind of do-your-own-thing.
Well, there was a hippie takeover, as you describe it, 1971, really.
Yeah, about 70, 71, the big hippie back-to-the-land movement, of which I was a part.
Yeah, and in fact, quite a part. You write about some of those salad days with great gusto. There's, in fact, there's a character I was thinking of, your nephew, many people recognize, is the author of the novel Boonville, and he has a middle name, Mailer, and you write about a character named Robert Mailer Anderson. You write a character named White Man, who was a counterculture figure who thought of himself, well, as I guess a white Indian. I mean, I think of Mailer because white Negro, of course.
Yeah, right.
This guy was a white Indian, right?
Yeah, a white Indian, yeah.
I mean, these characters out of the 60s that are brought back alive are just fascinating. One forgets of just what characters they were. And talk about psychopaths. Let me just go back a moment. You really left San Francisco because of the death of Paul Stein, because of the Zodiac.
Well, that was certainly an inspiration. I mean, in the late 60s, San Francisco had become not a happy place at all. And I think that the level of street violence and violence generally, I think, inspired much of the exodus north, the Back to the Land movement, that heavy drugs had taken over the Haight-Ashbury. And San Francisco had its own delegation of roaming psychopaths.
But then you went up to Mendocino and you had, a serial killer you write about named Arturo Flores. There's actually a guy who was a ward. Was he a ward of yours from the Black Gorilla family? Who was?
He went on to become an enforcer for the Black Gorilla family.
And he was you were sort of directly involved in his life. I mean, in many ways, weren't you?
Yes, he spent a part of his formative years with me, and I hope it wasn't me who drove him over the edge. But
well, he became a killer, essentially.
He became a killer. Yeah. Yes.
As did Huey Newton, and you write about Huey Newton and the kind of, support that he had and Free Huey and that whole movement, and then discovering, that he beat up a tailor and killed a prostitute and all those horrible things.
Yeah. Well, I was a founding member of the Peace and Freedom Party and actually attended as a delegate from the Noe Valley, the founding convention at the Richmond Auditorium, which was quite a show.
It was. You bring it alive. Also, right. The fascinating thing is Charles Schulz was a supporter of the Peace and Freedom Party presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Who would have thought? You get those kind of facts in there. Talk about facts. Reading your book, suddenly I'm discovering that Harry Bridges, who is an icon to be sure, but the great labor leader and labor reformer, you write about him not willing to take a paycheck to any degree higher than the people who were in the union.
Yes, that was one of the many remarkable things about the man. And a friend of mine's father, who was a warehouseman, was walking home from work one day and sent down near the waterfront, and Bridges pulled over and offered him a ride home. I think those days are long gone.
Yeah, you say today you'd see a union leader in the back of a limo.
Right.
Talking, by the way, with Bruce Anderson, whose book is The Mendocino Papers, Volume 1. How many volumes do you expect, Bruce?
I expect 5 or 6. The next is Mendocino crime stories, more or less contemporary stories that have appeared first in my paper.
And you wanted people to know about your family and your personal history in this book as well, not only because it's tied into the area, but you felt it's important that they should know who the author is.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Our origins and connections to this part of the country. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, what the guiding leitmotif, if you want to say, I mean, it's not as grand, but the idea of stories on top of the topography, on top of the landscape, the stuff that Rebecca Solnit, what work I admire very much, does very well. A lot smarter than I do, but I like that idea, and I think she's developed it quite well.
You do it quite well here as well. You also mentioned at one point that Slim Pickens was a rodeo announcer, and he called this area of Boonville, Mendocino County, the roughest place he'd ever called a rodeo in.
Yes, he did, and it was quite a rough place. The latter part of the war years and the early 1950s, when Southerners relocated to work in the mills of Mendocino County from the rural South. So it was a pretty tough place, and many of them were single men who would just move. They'd cut the trees down in one area and then move on. But in the Anderson Valley alone, just a relatively small area, there were more than 30 mills with accompanying mill shacks. And Friday and Saturday nights, the loggers and the mill workers would fight in downtown Boonville. And as Pickens said, he said it was the toughest place he'd ever been in.
The fighting was just taken for granted, as you pointed out in the book. I mean,
it was just part of the social ambiance.
Part of the culture, as it were.
Part of the culture.
Then you write about San Francisco also with some things that I think, many of our listeners might like to hear. For example, you write about Muni, you write about the city schools, and this is a little bit of the polemicist in you when you write about things like that. You
know? Yes. Yeah, I think so. Because I've watched the city and lived in the city and been in the city really since the late 1950s. So, I mean, I've seen its various transmogrifications, I guess you could say.
Well, at one point you say There have been obnoxious young slobs strewn up and down Haight Street for 40 years because the left-lib bloc that controls the vote in San Francisco says that public intoxication and living on the streets and in the parks are guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, which is a lot easier than taxing the comfortable to build cheap shelter and to revive the state hospital system for the armies of drunks and the drug-addicted stumbling along the main drag of a major tourist destination as if they had destinations other than self-induced oblivion. There's the battler. There's the provocateur. Yeah.
Well, and many of my liberal fans say, "Well, what are you talking about? Yeah, what kind of a right-wing attitude is that?" But I mean, there it is. Take it or leave it. I think at some levels, most of us feel that way. That somehow government at all levels has lost its way. I mean, if you can't house and keep people who are intent upon public suicide, if you can't keep them off the streets and do something with them and for them, I mean, what?
What is government?
Yeah, what is government? What's the point of government?
Well, you also write about the wealthy people in San Francisco sending their kids to Marin Country Day School in Corte Madera and then sending them back into the city. And you mentioned that in a kind of class division awareness way, but you say, why are they leaving the public schools? And the answer is rather polemical, too. The school board are a bunch of babbling fools, I think is what you say.
Well, I think so. The school board coverage that we do for my paper, or have done periodically over the years, I mean, I'll get a letter from New York, and they'll say, you know, the Boonville school board is exactly like our school board. I mean, they make bad decisions. They hire flawed administrators to run the schools, and the public system gets steadily worse. But it's striking. I think anybody who walks early in the morning in the northern tier of San Francisco, it's striking the number of school buses, private school buses, busing children out of San Francisco and across the Golden Gate Bridge for schools in Marin, or busing children to private schools in San Francisco. So ambitious parents, and certainly people of means, have pretty much, it seems to me, or have either abandoned or in the process of abandoning the schools. And I'm sure we could argue forever about the reason for that, but it's certainly a striking fact of life, it seems to me.
Talking to Bruce Anderson, editor and publisher of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a weekly newspaper that's based in Mendocino. He's also the author of a new memoir, Volume 1 of the Mendocino Papers. Talk a little bit about the role of your newspaper in the community you're in. What were some of your big battles that you fought journalistically?
The county system of education has been an ongoing battle of ours. Local planning matters has been another one. Local government generally, the performance of the district attorney's office and the public defender's office. I think we have the same sorts of problems that San Francisco has, only set down in this vast rural area with a professional class of people, teachers, school administrators, social workers, psychologists, judges, and the court system doing quite well, really, it seems to me, ultimately kind of fastened around the neck of working people and certainly the poor.
But you can ride herd and stir up grassroots to a much greater extent than people can, say, in San Francisco or Oakland or San Jose.
Yes, I can.
I mean, just because of the size of the community, for one thing.
The size of the community and the fact that I own the publication. Right.
What's made people in your area most angry that you've done over the years, you think?
Well, they're angry almost on a public, I mean, on a weekly basis. So I think the Judy Barry bombing controversy, that certainly made people angry. I took a minority position on that.
What was your position?
My position was that the ex-husband did it. And the position in the world outside, the Pacifica Network and so forth, was more of a vague responsibility. Everyone from the FBI to the timber industry to psychotic fundamentalist Christians.
We should mention that she was involved in the environmental movement and was, just for listeners who don't remember or know, involved in an incident in which a bomb was exploded, and the FBI was blamed by environmental crusaders and those who were certainly sympathetic to her, and in fact, she blamed them too. In fact, you take a kind of shot in your book at Pacifica and KPFA.
I see. You may corroborate this, but I find, and not that I just happen to be sitting here, and I admire your work very much, but you're just about the only talk show that I can listen to, and I think I speak for a lot of people out there. I found the Pacifica Network, which was important to me as a kid, because it was kind of a parallel educational system. You could tune in KPFA, and you'd hear a very wide variety of a much wider variety of opinion than you hear now, and a much more intelligent level of discussion, I think. And probably maybe that's occurred because there's been a general lessening of the book reading or the serious book reading public. But it seems to me a deterioration and into a kind of party lineism that has really no interest to me anymore. I feel like a complete alien listening to it.
Still feel like a lefty, though?
Well, I consider myself a person of the left. I think with the looming collapse or the end times or late capitalism, whatever we have going on now, I think we're all going. Most of us will be leftists pretty soon.
Well, boy, do you skewer the left of the '60s though in this book? You really do. I mean, I'm thinking about, for example, there's a guy named George meeting concerning Huey Newton, who stands up and says he wants to kill all white people, and he gets applause.
He got a standing ovation, and I said, you know, something's seriously awry here. I mean, it was Mario Savio was one of the only sane, not one of the only, but he was certainly a voice of sanity there. You know, he kept attempting to calm people down, but the rhetoric was completely over the top. And I think, like a lot of young people at the time, I mean, I'd been inspired by American writers like Dreiser and Dos Passos, and it didn't compute. I mean, this was the left, this maniacal left did not compute my notions of what the historical left was.
Somebody else you take on in your memoir is Mike Thompson. You know, you say the ex-hippies elected him, ex-hippies keep him in office, and you seem to have a kind of disdain for his saying he was spit on, though he did get a Purple Heart, of course, in Vietnam. I'm talking about the congressman from up north. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the famous spit-upon incident, which I'm sure you're aware that there was a book about, where a young author went to elaborate measures to track down every alleged spitting on the returning veteran episode that he could find, and he found none. And that was a myth then, and it's a myth now that's often invoked still by the right wing to rally support for whatever bloody scheme the national government is up to. But Thompson claimed to be spat upon when he returned from Vietnam, but
was the only one that was, possibly. I mean,
yeah, possibly.
This research you're talking.
Well, when we had looked at the logistics of it, when you landed at Travis upon return from Vietnam, and then you're bussed into San Francisco, I don't think there was any opportunity for that to have happened.
We're talking again with Bruce Anderson, who is editor and publisher of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, and you may indeed want to join us to talk with Bruce Anderson. I know he's got many fans and readers out there. Talk about what we're talking about, memories perhaps of another era, also Mendocino County and its history, which is really preeminent in this book. You can join us toll-free. Our number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, that's available to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can also send an email, and the email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum, and when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, spending the hour with Bruce Anderson, who edits and publishes the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a weekly newspaper based in Mendocino County. He's also the author of a new memoir called The Mendocino Papers, the first volume. And unfortunately, it's probably not all that available in your local bookstores here. And those of you who listen to this program know I'm a great supporter of independent bookstores. In fact, recipient of the unfortunately called Fibs Award, Friend of Independent Bookstores. But the book can be obtained off of Amazon.com and certainly is in some of the bookstores up north for those of you listening us up north. In fact, Bruce is going to be well, appearing at Mulligan Books in Ukiah, 7 p.m. That's tonight?
Tonight.
Tonight. So those of you who are listening to us way up north would like to avail yourself of meeting Bruce Anderson, you can do that tonight at 7 p.m. at Mulligan's Books in Ukiah. In the meantime, let's have our listeners meet Bruce Anderson. John, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Anderson. On the invaluable public service that is this show, I usually ask a question and take the answer off the air, but I'll stay on in case there's a rebuttal. Though I haven't seen the advertiser in some time, it's monitored for me. And not to detract from the role and the duty and the glory of the independent newspaper publisher, even if the product doesn't achieve the community stature, say, of the Hill Rag in Washington or the national stature of a Texas Observer. But Mr. Anderson, especially in the past 15 or 20 years, as a result of the expansion of the network, you can get anywhere in California now, almost, by a rail or coach services. Why is it, sir, that after all these years, on the subject of our regional railroad, you're still such a cretin?
I think you mean cretin, don't you?
Yeah,
are you opposed? Are you opposed to?
Well, I'm a cretin on lots of subjects, but no, I'm not. I'm not opposed to the railroad, but I think the dwindling number of proponents north of the proponents for restoring the railroad north of Willits are hoodwinking the public when they say that the Eel River Canyon, that a railroad can run through there again all the way to an entirely mythical deep water port in Eureka. It's just not going to happen. It would take tons of money. This is not the 1930s when rail crews lived in the Eel River Canyon and manually cleared the tracks in impossible weather and in impossible conditions for a railroad. The track has collapsed. The tunnels have collapsed. I mean, it would just take millions and millions of dollars. And with the economy in free fall, I just don't see that happening. And theoretically, it would be wonderful. We used to run two trains each way every day between Eureka and Sausalito. It's an amazing feat when you think about it. It wasn't that long ago.
But you see it really as an economic issue. You're not, the caller made it sound almost as if you're opposed in principle. You're not. You would love
Oh, no, I'm not opposed to principle. Yeah. I'm all for rail in theory.
Let me go to more calls from Berkeley. Evie, hi.
Hi. Yes, I want to talk about the paper in the 70s. We used to visit a man named Bob Glover, who was an expert in bootlink, the language of the Anderson Valley, and he lived next to the Floodgate store in Philo. Is that somebody that is still around and on the staff and that you may remember?
I wish you mentioned that bootlink is a separate language that's actually spoken in Boonville.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Glover has passed on. His widow is alive. And he was a very amusing and a lively fellow and one of the last bootling speakers, which was a kind, for people who've never heard of it, it was a kind of a pidgin English, a way for the locals who were quite isolated at the time to talk about visitors behind their backs.
Right.
Much of it, of course, reflected the times with ethnic slurs
and
speech that would be considered politically incorrect now. But it's a very lively read and remains so today. You can still find the bootling book. It's
can you understand bootling to this day?
I can get most of it.
Because I know Robert Mailer Anderson, your nephew, can, or at least I believe he can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They used to teach a class in it at the high school.
Yeah, and we used to also go to the big Apple Fair in Boonville. That was a wonderful event in the fall.
It's a great little country fair. Remains so.
Well, all the surrounding countryside were apple growers, and that's what the Anderson Valley was famous for.
Yes.
And we thank you, Evie, for your call, and we'll get our next caller on, and that happens to be Diamond Dave.
Yo, hey, Michael. Hey, Bruce. I'd be often sitting in my cafe and reading your newspaper, and I hear them vigiling. Is that the word across the a guy who is your brother, Rob Anderson, who is running for supervisor against the leftist establishment, the Green Party here, thinking about bike riders and so on, and from a individualist kind of right wing perspective. And I'm really interested to know what the relationship is between you, Bruce, an anarcho guy from the North Country, and Rob Anderson, stealing the hate. Your brother.
Rob Anderson is my brother, and he is the person who has, I guess, most aggressively opposed an expansion of bicycle lanes in San Francisco.
Among other things, I
want you to know that I arrived here by bicycle myself this morning.
There you go.
I don't share his antipathy for bicycles.
Thanks, Dave. We'll go to Oakland next. Amelia, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, what a wonderful interview. Fantastic. I'm curious as to whether Mr. Anderson's stories of psychopaths and criminals include the legendary lovable old Doc Stanley, who murdered someone on Albion Ridge some years back. I met this guy back in the old days at the Los Angeles Free Press when it was on Sunset Strip, and he was my introduction to what is a sociopath. One fellow says he's not old, he's not lovable, he's not a doctor, and his name isn't Stanley.
The last I heard, he finished his days when he was released from prison for that murder, which I think was reduced to typically of Mendocino County, by the way. I think it was a straight-up murder, but reduced to a manslaughter. So he was released, and the last I heard, he was living in a boat, a dry land boat near Stinson Beach or on the Bolinas Plateau.
Let me thank the caller. There's a story here that I wouldn't call it a psychopathic character. There are a lot of them, certainly, that punctuate this book, but there's a character who's called Blind Man, and a story that's told with, I think, it's ultimately a comedic story. I mean, you want to tell it?
Well, Blind Man was a legendary umpire based in Cloverdale.
Which is how he got his name, I guess.
You know? Yeah, right. in the old days when not that long ago, up into through the middle 70s when there were still fast pitch softball men's leagues. And he was the umpire because he would volunteer to umpire all day long. He loved it. But his umpiring was erratic, to say the least. And what's funny about him, everybody in town called him Blind Man, even little kids. And he'd begin umpiring games early in the morning, little league games, on through pony league games, and then men's league softball games in the afternoon. And you could visit Cloverdale, and three generations of people would be complaining about what he'd done to their son, uncle, or daughter in a softball game. A very amusing guy.
But the funny story is when a guy was injured, and it seemed like he was injured quite seriously. Fortunately, he wasn't. But Blind Man was screaming about him being out because he didn't follow along the base paths the way he should have. Yeah. Wasn't Cloverdale also where Richard Allen Davis was ultimately...
Richard Allen Davis had his connection to Mendocino County was that his sister is a registered Native American who lived north of Ukiah. So Davis was also a Native American, would visit his sister at that reservation. And he was arrested. This is a little known story, but he was arrested prior to the just ghastly murder of Polly Klass. He was arrested in Mendocino County for drunk driving. He should have, since he was on parole, he should have gone straight back to the state pen. But Mendocino County, the sheriff's department could not get his computer operating. They didn't know who they had, so he was released. He went on to murder the child.
We go to Phil. Phil, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi. Michael, I appreciate your show very much. And I wanted to just, however, offer one minor correction. There's a lot of us who work in the labor movement who very much work in the tradition of Harry Bridges. So not all of us are riding in limos right now. And on that point, I wanted to thank you, Bruce, for really focusing on the lives of working people in your paper. You know, you cover high school football. You know, you're a muckraker on behalf of the folks who don't have a lot of money. And I wonder if you could tell us, is there anything hopeful going on in your area on kind of reconciling the contradictions between environmentalists, environmental sustainability, and folks who work in the woodworking industry, including all the Latinos who, I guess, have immigrated to your area?
Yes, that's true. I mean, the struggles of working people, rural working people, are, of course, as intense as they are in urban areas. The timber wars are pretty much over, because the new owners of the logged over land by Georgia Pacific and Louisiana Pacific, whose cut and run policies in the 70s and early 80s has sort of decimated the industry and closed mills and really ran through it and put a lot of people out of work. But the timber industry will eventually revive because big time capital, like the Fisher family here of San Francisco owns great swaths of logged over land, and they're doing, I must say, they're doing a very good job rehabilitating the land and logging roads. Working people there, especially the recent immigrants, do a lot of work in the wine industry that is not fairly compensated, to put it mildly. There was one brief effort to unionize vineyard workers by the United Farm Workers, which was quickly undone by the large French winery that the vineyard workers briefly struck. There's no organized labor movement among vineyard workers at this time.
We thank the caller. That may change, of course.
I mean,
the unions are always looking for ways to branch out and bring in more membership. And Mark from Escondido, join us. Good morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a little bit of exception, I guess, to your comment about the returning Vietnam vets that not being spit on. If you could find no validation, well, I'm here to validate it. I was returned to Travis in July of 69 and was spit on right at the getting off the airplane on the way into the little terminals they had there.
Bruce Anderson.
That 1959 is pretty early for one of those.
I think he said 69.
Oh, 69. Yeah. I'm sorry. Well, I'm sorry that it happened, and I'm sorry that you eluded the book on the subject.
The author never found you, apparently, Mark. No. I appreciate your calling, and we'll get more calls on. We'll get Elizabeth on next. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. I'm really happy to hear about this book. My husband's family, a large part of his mother's side, came from Kovlo, and one of the things that I was interested in was finding out if you thought there would be another chance for Genocide and Vendetta by Estelle Beard and Frank Caranco being released by the University of Oklahoma, or if the lawsuit's going to tie it up forever. It's a wonderful book. I have a copy.
It is a wonderful book, and it's quite a rare book now. You just can't find it, and it was an enormous work of scholarship. They did such a terrific job, and it's just a shame it's out of print. But I would think that after a certain period of time that it would be eligible for reprint regardless.
I would think a university press, University of Oklahoma Press or Missouri or even...
They do a lot of work on Native American. Of course, there's the great Heyday Press right here in the Bay Area by Malcolm Margolin, who does a lot of books on Native Americans. He's almost single-handedly retrieved much of that early grizzly history.
Again, we're talking to Bruce Anderson of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. His book is The Mendocino Papers, and... go to emails here in just a moment. If you'd like to join us by phone, you can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. Think about the future of newspapers. You call yourself the last newspaper, and that says it all, I guess, maybe, doesn't it?
I think it's the last newspaper by default when we consider that in the 19th century, a newspaper person could not only own the technology, he could operate it. He could get up and move to the next town when he made people angry. And a sole proprietorship, especially a newspaper like mine, again, I say by default, I'm not bragging here. I don't know of another one like it in the country that's outspoken about a range of issues.
Here's Betsy, who says, did your guests read the accounts of the West Coast and specifically California Native Americans in Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee? I don't recall that book describing Mendocino, but recall the discussion of the California tribes as being far less warring than the tribes in the interior of the United States. Is this anything you learned about in your research?
The Native Americans of Mendocino County were so overwhelmed immediately that, and of course they didn't have guns and they didn't have horses. They might still be holding out if they'd had guns and horses in the Eel River outback, but they didn't. And the nature of their societies, of course, meant that when the settlers arrived with their small herds of cattle and horses, the Native American communities, tribes, were immediately disrupted because their food sources and everything else that they depended on for their lives disappeared. And of course, they were... exterminated, often shot on sight by the first settlers who regarded them simply as a nuisance. By contrast, the missions, the old Spanish missions, were positively humanitarian because at least they believed that the Indians were human beings and that they had souls worth saving.
They wanted to convert them, yeah.
At 1850, in the Gold Rush wave of settlers, did not believe that.
Couple more emails before I go to more of your calls. This is from a listener named Bruce, who says, concerning your comment that they blame the FBI for not investigating anything but them, may I remind you that after over a decade in court, Cherney and Berry won their case against the FBI.
Which was a libel case. I mean, it wasn't a case about the mechanics of the episode.
Again, the environmental activists we alluded to before who were involved in a bombing incident. Here's Janet, who says, I was just wondering if Anderson has written about her plans to write about the Doss family. Helen Doss's memoir, The Family Nobody Wanted, chronicles how she and her husband, who was Boonville's Methodist minister, adopted 12 children, most of them mixed race or otherwise unadoptable, in the 30s and 40s.
A very interesting person. I believe she was the founder of a place called Clearwater Ranch, and a remarkable woman. That's certainly on my list.
She'll be in one of them.
Well, one of them, I hope.
Let's get John on here. Hi, John.
Hey, Bruce. This is John Corey. You may remember me. I was working at Channel 5, and I did a piece on you and Wanda Tanasky.
Yes.
Wanda Tanasky. That's a name I haven't heard in years.
It's a great story, and I think it sort of speaks to the Bruce's literary taste, but also the irreverent nature of the advertiser. But I was wondering if Bruce could tell the tale for the listeners, because I think they'd get a big kick out of it.
That's the whole Thomas Pynchon thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we thought for a long time that the person writing these letters to my paper was Thomas Pynchon, who was in the area to write.
Well, he wrote Vineland. Yeah,
he wrote Vineland from up in that area. So we got this series of erudite, meticulously typed letters from a person adopting the persona of a bag lady who was living under various bridges in Mendocino County. And from behind her persona, I mean, she attacked the
this local, is Wanda Tanasky.
This was the Wanda Tanasky figure. But the person who was writing them had gone to an enormous lengths to insinuate himself as Thomas Pynchon, which led to a lot of the confusion, scholarly arguments about it, and until finally Wanda Tanasky was revealed by the great prose analyst Don Foster as an alienated former postal worker, an old beatnik from San Francisco, erudite fellow, who had moved and retired to Fort Bragg and was amusing himself by writing these letters, taking on local political figures. Very fine letters, very funny letters. And that was the end of that saga, I think, unless Pynchon turns out to have actually have done it.
Well, there was a rumor back a couple of years ago that Pynchon was going to come out of his hiding and actually be made public, that he was convinced by his then lady friend that it was okay. He had been supposedly so overly self-conscious about his teeth that his teeth got fixed and he was supposed to get... This is the story. I heard it from some pretty good sources, but it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, that his college roommate at Cornell was Richard Farina.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Very talented writer.
Here's Rick, who says, thank the Almighty, a lefty who admits that KPFA is a parody of its original self. And another listener says, what do you think of the portrayal of you as a character in the fictional book, Boonville?
Well, I thought my nephew was quite benign, considering what he could have done to me.
And here's Steve, who says, saw copies of Bruce's books at the Friends of the San Francisco Library bookstore in Fort Mason the other day, if anyone's interested. That's from a fellow Cretan and big fan of yours, Steve Heilig. Here's a listener who says, you haven't even mentioned the Hendy Woods Hermit.
The Hendy Woods Hermit didn't make my book, but he was a famous character there who lived for years, assumed to be or rumored to be, or I don't think it was ever factually established. I only caught a fleeting glimpse of him once. He lived in a redwood stump at Hendy Woods, now a park, and he was said to be a Russian sailor who had jumped ship in San Francisco and made his way there, and people would leave food out for them and lived there for a period of years from middle 60s maybe through the early 70s.
And we'll take more phone calls from Windsor. Don, good morning.
Hi, Michael and Bruce. Bruce, I wanted to let your listeners know about Walking Tractor, which is a marvelous collection of pieces that I think first appeared in the AVA, and I think you were responsible largely for convincing Bruce Patterson to get it published, weren't you?
I hope so, because he's a very good writer, and that's a series of essays by Patterson about logging, again about the land, and they're very good. They're published by Heyday Books. Malcolm Margolin, who was mentioned earlier,
one of our heroes. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's having just read it, I just think it would lend itself to high school literature classes, letting kids, you know, learn about their own Northern California environs. And
one would hope.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don, for the call. Early on in the book, we did a program about the whole controversy over providing a barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge. And early on in your book, you talk about it as a magnet for suicide. How do you feel about a barrier? Where do you come down on that?
Just off, without giving the matter much thought, I mean, just knowing and what I've read, I'd be opposed to it.
Because?
Because I'm afraid when everything is boiled down. I agree with William Faulkner, who said, owed in a Grecian urn is worth X number of...
Grandmothers. Walking over grandmothers.
Yeah, I don't think you should monkey around with that wonderful aesthetic. And I'm sorry that people jump off it and die. And the one idea I heard that I liked, it seems like some kind of a compromise, would be bridge monitors, people who were walking up and down all day long.
Yeah, that came up in the discussion.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, you write a good deal about Jim Jones and his speed use, that is, use of amphetamines, his charisma, but also, interestingly enough, as an integrator.
Well, one of the first in Mendocino County, because his church was composed largely of black people from the Bay Area, who, of course, he betrayed in the ghastliest way in history, yeah. Maybe.
But Anderson Valley High School, actually, he was involved in it.
He was an elementary school teacher in Boonville. He taught the fifth grade for 2 years. When he arrived in California, he needed to work, and that was his job. He commuted from the Ukiah area every day over the hill to teach the fifth grade. And there's still people around who swear that he was a terrific teacher. Just as Leonard Lake, the mass murderer, people say he was a volunteer fireman in Boonville, and people say, yeah, he might have been a nut, but he had the most beautiful handwriting. He was the best recording secretary we've ever had.
There's a sense, though, that there's tremendous naivete where Jones was concerned, particularly. Not only naivete,
tremendous.
Something even beyond naivete, really.
Tremendous. And once you get beyond the circulation areas of the Bay Area papers, there's a media vacuum. And so a person like Jones, the media was on him pretty fast once he relocated to San Francisco. But in Mendocino County and his church, that's really where he picked up his steam, because he was milking his group homes for a range of dependent persons and salting that away. And he basically got this nest egg going in Mendocino County, where at least a lot of people were, this guy isn't quite right, but there was really no place to alert people that he wasn't quite right. And then he moved on to San Francisco.
Well, in fact, you at one point aim your arrows a bit at Willie Brown and others who were taken in by him and then who tried to explain it in different ways later on as the years progressed. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's where the media, fell down, certainly the rural media. I think he could have been stopped much earlier.
Tim is our next caller. Tim, good morning.
Yes, Mr. Anderson, to talk about Cretans and Greek mythology, owed to a Grecian urn. You think of the youth of Athens dying at the hands or the mouth of the Minotaur in the labyrinth. But when you think about the Bay Area, the greater Bay Area and the news media, what's your opinion about the celebrity status of the most famous child, perhaps, in California history, as far as we're looking at advertising and publicity, and that would be Kevin Collins, the missing child. What's your thought about why there hasn't been any studies, sociological studies, about his celebrity status?
Well,
even though he's
Unfortunately, he was just...
I think JonBenet Ramsey may have greater...
Yeah, he was an earlier version of that.
But he disappeared. What happened to him?
Disappeared right off Haight Street.
He was going to get a bus to school. And
was gone. I think it's just terrible. Well, one of the themes of my book is that when you consider 400 years ago, probably Native Americans sighted that first puff of white sail off the Pacific coast, and in a mere 400 years, we've come to whatever we've come to. I mean, when you consider the Native Americans were here from 8 to 12,000 years, living harmoniously with the land and the resources, and we are to where we are, collapsing banks and the rest of it. It's really quite remarkable.
It's an epic.
It's an epic, and history has accelerated, and who knows where it's taking us.
We've got, a strange caller on here, somebody very benign where you're concerned. Join us, please, caller.
Hello, this is Robert Mailer Anderson. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Mike. Hi, Robert.
Hey.
My question is, Bruce, when you end up leaving the Valley, will people talk in the same tones as about you as they do about Jim Jones and Leonard Lake and Tree Frog Johnson and all the other heroes?
I'm sure I'll be right in there.
You'll be right in there?
Yeah, at least in the top five.
In the pantheon of sluggers?
Top five.
Never killed anyone that we know of, though. Uncle hasn't.
No. How many times? A couple of fights at school boards, though. He punched the superintendent of schools and then the little-known...
Well, he writes about it.
As Nixon said, mistakes were made. That was a scuffle, greatly exaggerated by my enemies
first,
in the corporate
though.
Media.
He jumped you first, but you stood your own, right?
Yes.
Yeah, which is what guys are supposed to do. And anyway, Robert, good to hear from you, and good to have you on here. Pleased to have had you on here. The book, again, is The Mendocino Papers, and... Bruce Anderson, editor and publisher of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, weekly newspaper based in Mendocino County. He'll be in Ukiah tonight, Mulligan's Book, 7 o'clock. And we want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory, to our interns, Joey Kahn, Shazia Joffrey, Kelly Pretzer, Megan Rollins, and Allison von Diggelin. And our engineer is Danny Bringer, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.